Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spearco with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, September the 25th, 2025, and it is Thursday. That means it is time for an expert counsel Q&A show for the week, and I've got a big lineup for you today. One or two segments more than typical because I actually have a surplus. Yeah, I ain't gonna get attached to this. I got a surplus of content from the expert council right now. That doesn't happen often. I almost have enough material from EC right now that if I wanted to, I could do next week's show today and take next week off. I ain't gonna do it, and I don't have quite enough for that. I've got more than enough segments, but some of them are from, you know, multiple segments from the same council member. But I could probably make it work. I would just be lacking the Ron Paul Liberty highlight for the week. That'd be it. So if you are an expert council member and you do not hear a segment you sent me today, you have done nothing wrong. It's simply I went way back to some older ones, and I got like a bazillion from Andy McCann, so I want to make sure I start burning through those, and kind of went forward unless it was a topical thing, something that was temporal-based. Like I got Nicole on today because she's also talking about Self-Reliance Festival in her segment, so that happens very, very soon. So anyway, who do we got? Ron Paul and Dynamic Adams are going to ask a very simple question. If Trump is the peace president, why does he keep threatening war? Latest threats are in regards to Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan. Do you think that the United States really needs to ever put a toe of our presence in Afghanistan ever again? Did we not learn anything from 20 years of shit? Well, apparently not. But, of course, we want it because it imposes a threat of potential force into places like China, very much over the horizon reach there, as though Japan doesn't and some other places. Yeah, okay. But anyway, Nicole Sauce is going to continue part three of her resilience series, this one on community, and why community literally is survival. Matt Sersley is going to talk about a subject near and dear to my heart, because I hear one of you people spouting something like this at least once a week. Sometimes I would estimate there's probably 20 a month. You got to get this guy on, man. He will show you how you never pay tax again. Even one of my good friends has been spouting this nonsense, Mr. Bush. Please stop listening to the tax scammers. Matt Sersley is going to debunk a lot of these claims about how you cannot pay taxes legally. What you can do legally is barely pay taxes. That's what you can do legally. And I think one of the things most people don't realize is unless you are upper income, significantly upper income, or you are like solid middle, upper middle class, and you have no dependents whatsoever, it is most likely the case that the most tax you pay isn't income tax. It's Social Security, even without looking at the other side of it. Just a little cherry on top there. Andy McCann will talk about a grab bag of non-serious questions for some fun that are somewhat related to fitness, like, how do I train to fight zombies with a goat and a shovel? I'm not kidding. He got a little grab bag of some non-serious questions. He's going to have some fun with them, and I think that's good because we shouldn't be taking serious stuff serious all the time. There's enough serious going on in the world today. But back to something serious, but not overly serious. Joel Riles is going to talk about correcting repetitive behavior issues with your dog, something a dog does over and over again that you don't want it to do. But there's a hack to this, I guess, or a technique to this, and it's called body language. Dogs in general will tell you they're about to do something before they actually do it. And if you can identify that, that is the time to issue correction. And Joel's going to talk about that. And look, I understand Joel is one of like those dog whisperer type guys, right? Like, I've got it, he's got it in spades, and there are people who have an instant resonance with dogs, the way some people that are beekeepers can do things that a normal person can get the shit stung out of them. My old bee mentor, Jason, could take and barehand bees out of the hive in clumps and set them on top of the, and look for the queen and not get stung, because he would literally slow his respiration and his heart rate down to the point where the bees didn't see him as a threat. And so when you start talking about reading the dog's body language for correction prior to the infraction, you start thinking, well, you have to be able to do that. But you don't, because you have your dog. And if you're on alert and you see what precedes the actual behavior, what you're going to find often is it's the same thing every time. There's certain things dogs do. You see a dog do certain things, you know what's going to come next. But then dogs are individuals on top of it. And that actually works to your strength, because you don't have to be a Joel Riles to be able to use this. He'll talk more about that. Then Kerry Brown's going to talk about two plants to forage this time of year, ironweed and Joe Pye weed. So that should be a good segment. Then Patrick Rohrman's going to do something I've never seen done before. I don't know if you've ever heard of the Iron Triangle. But the Iron Triangle is a principle of project management, but it's also something we used to use back in when I used to sell computer hardware and networking equipment. We'd say you could have it fast, reliable, or cheap. Those are your three choices, and you can have any two of them. You can have it fast and reliable, but it won't be cheap. You can have it fast and cheap, but it won't be reliable. And there's a lot of different versions of it. He's taken it and applied it to sharpening knives. Steel type, edge angle, and things like that. I think it's a really cool segment, and it does show that this, what I call rule of threes, can be applied in so many places. And I don't mean the Iron Triangle as a rule of threes. I mean rule of threes, period. And maybe I'll have a little add-on to that. Why I always like to use three things when I'm marketing or telling a story, and how that fits with this. And then I've got a short segment at the end, and it's just an observation that I have about all of this political violence. We just had yesterday some nut job take an old military surplus rifle in Dallas onto the top of a building. That starts to sound remarkably familiar to something from history. But he decided to shoot up an ICE facility, and he shot at an ICE van, and he did manage to injure and kill. The problem is he hit three people. I'm hesitant to even report this because the numbers, the ratios keep changing. But the last I read, injured two, killed one. I had already heard killed two, injured one. So I don't know. I'd also heard yesterday that one was an ICE agent, the other two were detained illegal aliens. What I read this morning was one dead, two injured. Well, I don't know if that's true, but all three detained illegals. So one way or another, this didn't work out the way the guy planned, and then he killed himself. But, you know, this is on the heels of Charlie Kirk. That's on the heels of Inria, who was the young Ukrainian refugee that was just murdered on a train and no one helped her. And all of these acts of political violence and all this political violence celebration. The violence itself is terrible, but to have, you know, people killed and then have people going, well, screw them, they deserved it, they had it coming, lie about what they said. All of this political violence, I won't say it's just violence, it's violence and endorsement thereof. Have you ever thought about the fact that people who can win an intellectual debate don't commit acts of violence over intellectual debates? There's certain things, if you can actually, you don't even have to win. If you can effectively debate your side of an issue, then you tend not to use censorship or violence or threats of violence on the other side. So if you're wondering why the violence seems to be so overweighted to one side, and yes, I know some blonde chick that was a state legislature woman that was in Wisconsin or somewhere in the Midwest was murdered, and that was political violence by the right, and no, because no one knew who she was. No one specifically targeted her because she was on the left. She was killed by somebody who was angry with her that knew her. Right, and that's still wrong. But the big thing is, you didn't see the right going, "Oh, good. I'm glad she got shot. She spoke hate speech." Or so. We don't do that. Why don't we do that? I submit to you because in the lion's share of issues, and especially the issues that are important to people right now, the right has such an advantage on an intellectual level that the left cannot debate it in good faith. I'll submit it to you this way as an example. It is impossible to have an intellectual debate that is taken seriously, where one side's assertion is that a man can become a woman by wearing clothes, taking hormones, having surgery, and putting on a dress. That man is still a man. I am sorry. I completely believe in that individual's right to live as a woman if he chooses. And if I can't tell the difference, I'll even call him ma'am. If I can't tell. If it's even, like, I'll default to whatever it looks like. It's not about that. It's that you can't expect society to endorse your mental illness. And it is a mental illness. I already think there's something wrong with the person that wants to live as what they're not. But it's benign. It doesn't hurt anybody, so go do it. But when a person literally believes that they can become a thing they are not, it is just as much a mark of mental illness to believe you can change your sex, change your gender, as it is to believe that you can become a space alien or an Easter bunny. It is that easy to understand. And no matter how much bullshit and rhetoric they put into it, and this is the issue, and this is why so many of these conspiracy documentaries are so effective. As long as what you're saying isn't challenged, you can make a case for anything ridiculous and convince about half the people that look at it that it's real. But the minute that is intellectually challenged on any level, it falls apart. Well, these people have been, and I say these people, and I mean the indoctrinated left, which is about 20 to 30% of the country, are fully indoctrinated into this lunacy now. They have been told this and reinforced with this for so long, they believe it. And the cognitive dissonance that is created when they are confronted with fact, not opinion, counter to their beliefs, results in cognitive agony. And that, for some people who are particularly mentally ill, will result in acts of violence. And I just read a study. This was just by asking people. They asked women under 30, do you think that you have a mental illness? 50% of women under 30 voluntarily stated, yes, I have a mental illness. Okay? If you don't see how that's all correlated, maybe when I get to my segment, you will. So that's what we're going to be talking about today. I have an announcement today, and I'm going to try to make this announcement as many ways as possible to make sure everybody hears it. We have our workshop coming up in November. It's still on. It's happening. It's not going away. I've heard some people worried about that. We're doing it. It is happening. If you bought a ticket, you get to come. The place you go is what's changing. We are moving it back to my place at Nine Mile Farm. Thank God we didn't sell out at 85, because I don't know what I would have done if that happened. We sold, like, by the time people asked for refunds and stuff, we got 60. And I always lose some people, and I just won't try to replace them this year if I lose them. And 60 we can do. We've done 65 here. It does work. So we are moving it back here. The reasons are complex, but the short version thereof is we lost the venue. We cannot do it at YMCA. So we are going to do one more at the farm. There's actually a lot of people that are coming that I've talked to already that are happy about it. They'd rather be here than somewhere else, and I understand. So I'll be sending out an email with some updated information to everybody that bought a ticket. I'm hoping I get that done today. But one way or another, I'm going to reach out by email. I might even sit down and individually text people or something to make sure that everybody just knows. And all it is you just drive to a different place. It's the same dates, the same, the menu's the same, the speakers are the same, everything's the same. And if you're flying in, there's literally no difference, because the time to travel from DFW airport to the YMCA we were going to be at versus my house is within 2 minutes of each other. So it's the same distance from the airport, it's in the same city, it's all this, and it's what we've done for 12 years, and I figured out that we've done 34 events here. So we know how to do it, so it's not... I'm not happy about it, but I'm not mad about it. I'm more concerned about some money I spent that I didn't have to. That's about the only problem here. And I've had a few friends in my life have some things go on this week. I had a rough week. My problems right now feel like they're not even worth mentioning. compared to some of the things I've heard from some people happened to them this week. And, you know, thoughts and prayers out to all of y'all who are in that group. And it's not one. It's more than one. Anyway, with that out of the way, let's go ahead and hear from Dr. Ron Paul and Dan McAdams on if Trump's the peace president, why does he keep threatening war, the Afghanistan edition?
We want to start off with not a brand new subject. I thought we had buried this subject. After 20 years and how many billion dollars and lives spent doing this, and that is that if Trump doesn't like Afghanistan people, he wants to go back there and reform them. He wants to take care of them. He's demanding that our air base be returned to us. We built it. We paid for it. It's our air base. Bagram Air Base. So he's laid down the law. And he says that if they don't turn it over, they're in for trouble, and they had to do it now. So that's a pretty strong statement, not anything new for the president. We argued against the case of going in there in Afghanistan in the first place.
Yeah.
At 20 years, and it was a total failure. And here they are starting up again.
Well, it's just the peace president can't stop threatening war, it seems like, you know. And we understood that we were going to have an unconventional president in Trump 2.0. And to the things that we saw when he was up for the election, we liked. I mean, unconventionality is pretty good when the status quo is rotten to the core. But unfortunately, what we're seeing here is a president who keeps threatening countries, threatening to invade, threatening all sorts of things. Now, So here's what he exactly said. He said, Afghanistan doesn't give Bagram Air Force Base back to those that built it, the United States of America, bad things are going to happen. President DJT Donald J. Trump is what he says. Now let's listen, because he was in an interview, Dr. Paul, where he discussed why he wants that airbase back so badly. If you want to grab your earpiece, here, let's put it in and hear what he has to say.
They just went through the Afghanistan total disaster for no reason whatsoever. We're going to leave Afghanistan, but we're going to leave it with strength and dignity. And we're going to keep Bagram, the big air base, that one of the biggest air bases in the world. We gave it to them for nothing. We're trying to get it back, by the way. Okay, that could be a little breaking news. We're trying to get it back because they need things from us. We want that base back. But one of the reasons we want the base is, as you know, it's an hour away from where China makes its nuclear weapons. So a lot of things are happening.
So that's the cat out of the bag, Dr. Paul. They want it back because it's an hour's drive from where China makes its nuclear weapons. We want to occupy a base so that we can start threatening China more. That seems to be his plan.
And you know what goes through my mind as I listen to him? Empire, empire, empire.
Yeah.
You know, not only maintaining, but making sure it never shrinks and make sure that we can expand whenever possible. So it's part of the empire, and we need it back. And those Afghanis should know better.
Yeah.
And so the threats go out.
This is what Dave DeCamp at antiwar.com wrote. Well, Trump claims the U.S. built Bagram. The airfield was first constructed by the Soviet Union. Bagram became the largest U.S. military base in Afghanistan following the 20-year U.S. war in the country, and U.S. forces pulled out of the airfield during the withdrawal in 2021. The president made similar comments when he was on the campaign trail in 2024, saying if he were still president during the withdrawal, he was going to keep Bagram and leave 4,000 troops at the facility. Well, I don't know, Dr. Paul, those of us who were watching just a few years ago remember the circumstances of our withdrawal from Afghanistan. I don't think they were in the mood for us to keep anything at that point.
So for the special people in my audience, I have to say, as I give my take, I'm not endorsing anything. I'm analyzing it politically, like a political shill who tells presidents how to act. So if that doesn't work for you, I don't care. Because I told you, so now you know. Anyway, send your hate mail to jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com with TSPC, I'm a special idiot, in the subject line, in response to what I'm about to say. Politically, by Trump, this is actually a pretty savvy move. Now, doing it is stupid. Logistically, it's dumb. The last thing we should be doing is even thinking about touching poking, playing with, being in any way involved with Afghanistan. Did the Soviets build it? Well, yeah, but what they built is not what we built. I love Dan and I love Ron, but what's there today was built by America. I'm sorry, it is. Trump then qualified that with rebuilt. And that's important for a reason. When a president says something in the middle of politically contentious climates, he's trying to get his base to think a certain way, to act a certain way, to vote a certain way, to support things a certain way, and he wants them fired up. A lot of you are too young to remember what it was like to be walking around and understanding what was happening around you, let's say in the early 1980s, like 82, 83. But let me tell you something. When somebody said something that was patently ridiculous, like, we should go back into Vietnam and kill all those sons of bitches that killed our boys and make it right, about half the people were like, hell yeah, we should! Now, if there was a bigger complete clusterfuck than the Vietnam conflict for the United States of America, I don't know what it was. Like, it was, Vietnam was worse than Afghanistan, and Afghanistan is a close second, okay? But people still thought that way. So why is this politically savvy? Because those people are like, oh, yeah. And then the people that are pro-Trump that don't want to do this are like, gravel, grouse, don't really care, right? And then the people that really are upset by it will never support him anyway, so you lose nothing. You gain something and lose nothing. Politically, that's savvy. Okay, the next thing is, even if they don't do anything, if they don't ever even mention it again, the effect of Trump stood up for America again is in their heads. It doesn't mean it's true. It means it's what they think. Again, special people, right? Just put TSPC, I'm an idiot, in your subject line when you get mad at me for saying this. I'm not endorsing it, okay? But do it anyway. Send me your hate mail. It's fine. I'll laugh at it and delete it. Maybe I'll even read you on the air if you're very special, right? Just for fun. But what I'm saying is, this type of political gamesmanship is not smart, but it's politically savvy. And the reason you need to understand that is because both sides do it all the time. You pick a fight you're never actually going to fight. You gin up support, and then people are, he stood up for America again. Now, the other side of this is, militarily, I guarantee you, some upper echelon ass-kissing brass put this in his head. They would very much like to have over-the-horizon major air capabilities on the other side of China and into Russia to reassert that dominance of the military dominance that's there. We do have other ways we can reach those locations, lots of them. But this is a very old-school U.S. War footing gamesmanship that we've always done. We always claim everybody else is the ones out to get everybody, but then we surround them with all our military assets to be like, hey, if y'all want to F around, you will FO. I'm not endorsing that. I'm saying it's what we do. So it fits that doctrine. It fires up his base. If somehow, some way he pulls it off, it's this huge orange man victory lap like Dale Earnhardt back in the day in the black car, right, around the thing. And if he doesn't pull it off, he won't lose anything for it. Because he's not going to keep driving it. And he's already shown he could say dumb shit, walk away from it, and it just goes away. So it's a political maneuver that may not ever even be intended to actually happen, but they also look at it like, if it does, okay, then we can claim victory. Again, I'm not endorsing it. That's my analysis. Moving on, let's hear about community equaling survival from Nicole Sauce.
Howdy, TSP. Nicole Sauce here from the Living Free in Tennessee podcast and Howler Roast Coffee, and I have the next iteration of the resilience series that we're doing. This is number 3, and it's all about community. In fact, community is survival, and the only way to build it is face-to-face. So if you feel isolated, it's not your fault, but it is your move. You can be the most prepared person in the world, but without a real community around you, you're still pretty vulnerable. Like, think about if things go south and you're required to actually defend against the zombie apocalypse. How long can you stay awake guarding your stuff, for example? And, you know, that's the extreme example, but think about how much it makes your life better to have community when it is not the zombie apocalypse. The right people, the ones who will show up when you want to move or when you're sick, or maybe share bulk orders, order a semi-truck of something, and then divide it among a big community and save a bunch of money. Bring food when your freezer dies, or, you know, any of the other things that can happen in your life. Somebody gets sick. They're much more than a monthly meetup about how to organize as things get tough or how to trap animals, right? In fact, I think about a friend of mine who was in a terrible motorcycle accident here, and I was monitoring our county crew, and we try to keep people from posting who it is until their next of kin have been notified. Luckily, he didn't die, but they thought he was never going to walk again. And his wife got that call that you never want to get. But what happened after I realized who it was is I was able to reach out to her and ask her what she needed, because we have a real relationship. I have her phone number. I know where she lives, and I've met her dogs. And that was important because he was life flighted. She went to the hospital where he was, and her dogs were just shut inside the house. Nobody to take care of him. And they were the kind of dogs that you might not want just anybody walking in on, because they might actually bite you. And she asked me if I could go over and just like let him out the poop so she didn't have to deal with poop in the house when she got home, feed him if they'd let me. And I was able to do that for her. And that's because we had a real relationship. That's an example of a very real thing that can go wrong, that having a strong community around you is super important. Your community is your foundation for progress, whether times get tough or even if they don't. A few days ago, I was talking to Brenda, who comes to the Self-Reliance Festival, and she came to her first one without a lot of community in her immediate area. But after that first festival, when we did a connection session, she went home with real relationships, and she was telling me that some of her closest friends who've become more like family than her own family came from that first festival. She told me how grateful she was about the festival. And here's the kicker. That was the week where I was starting to question whether Self-Reliance Festival is worth me investing so much time and passion and effort in putting together. Because, spoiler alert, it's not a moneymaker for me. And it takes a lot of time. And I always feel so great after the festival watching how people's lives have changed and who they've met and what they've started building on their own in their own communities. And that conversation really reminded me how important community is when people find their people and how that can change the entire trajectory of your life. And yet, the kicker is many of us still feel pretty isolated. It's we know we need connection, but we don't really know how to build it. That's why we always get this question over and over. How do I build community? Well, why is this? Often it's because of excuses. And you have to own your stuff on this one. Excuses like, I'm an introvert and can't meet people. I'm an introvert and I have met people. It's too dangerous to travel right now because of all the division. Okay, so we know there was an assassination 2 weeks ago now, and it's too dangerous to travel, right? When is it ever really safe to travel? That's a question. So you can take steps to be situationally aware. You can travel to places where you're less likely to have problems if there are problems. I'm just too tired. That's a big one. And I know, because you get tired, especially when you don't have community around you and you're like, I don't want to deal with it. And sometimes you should just rest. But other times you should put your big boy and girl pants on and get your butt out there and meet some people in person. If you don't build community on purpose and with purpose, you're going to be stuck hoping it'll show up or that you'll fall into it by accident. And I don't think that's how real long-term resilience works. So what can you do? Like, I like to say, start small. Let's do something we can actually do. Find one person near you. One person. Go to a local event. Go to Self-Reliance Festival. Go to Jack's Workshop. Go to Exit and Build Land Summit. Hit your farmer's market. Host a movie night at the county complex, something. And talk to somebody who you're like, you know what, this person gets it. And then start doing something together. Potlucks, projects, meetups, fix a fence, cut up a tree, go to a local lake cleanup. We have a local lake cleanup here in a little while to get all the trash from around the lake from people in the summer. It doesn't have to be big. You don't need 500 people with matching t-shirts and a big web portal and a Facebook group and super cool acronyms and nicknames. In fact, I think people get that part backwards by prioritizing volume over quality, because a strong community of 2 to 5 beats a dysfunctional giant community every time. The way that the community here in Tennessee was able to get aid to East Tennessee when we had all the flooding about this time last year was because some of us knew each other really well, and like I trusted people to stay here on their way there. I trusted my generator to just be whisked away and handed to somebody, and I hoped it would come back. It's because we knew each other in person. So a strong community of 2 will beat it, or a strong community of 5 will beat a community of 500 who are infighting and political and maneuvering and all of those things. And why does this even matter, though? Community isn't about friendship, although friendships come from strong community. It's about resilience. It's about leaning into conflict and resolving it with respect. It's about real, practical, boots-on-the-ground sort of self-reliance things. People have started calling it community reliance instead of self-reliance for a reason. A strong community leads to more financial stability. Self-reliance doesn't work if you're doing it completely alone. And when you organize around core interests and core skills that you have and doing real projects and with common shared values, not fantasy scenarios, you make meaningful progress now, not someday. Because someday is what is coming to kill you. You need community because it is one of the 7 forms of capital, and you're going to need all the forms of capital if you are building long-term resilience into your life. If you want to meet people in person in about a week and a half in Camden, Tennessee, come on out to the Self-Reliance Festival. Coupon code SRF gets you 10% off. Website is selfreliancefestival.com. We're going to be doing all sorts of things, including watching Red Dawn. Make it a great week.
Great stuff as always from Nicole. And what I like about when Nicole talks about community, there's a lot of people that talk about community. And their accomplishment with community is kind of what she said isn't really that desirable, which is they built a great big Facebook group or something. Nicole's built an actual community. Like, when someone needs something in her community, she or someone else in that community that's kind of a leader in it can reach out and in a few minutes find someone that can help them. Now, that's community. So when she talks about community, y'all need to listen, because you're listening to someone that actually has done it in the real world in a really meaningful way. Nicole's been able to help me with a need or two that I've had in the past just by sending a text message or making a phone call. That's community, and that's powerful. Next up, let's talk about tax scams. As in, you really don't have to pay income tax. There's no law. No one can show you the law. Yeah, they'll show you the law, and they'll show you the handcuffs, too. I give you Matt Sersley on this topic. So I'm glad he did this, because now I don't have to say it for a while again.
Hey, TSP. Matthew Sersley of AgoristTaxAdvice.com here. Now, you know I hate taxes. Taxation is absolutely theft. If I could make them go away tomorrow, I would do it. And I don't think there's a moral duty to pay taxes, except I got to stay out of jail to take care of my family. And that's why I pay taxes. It's extortion. But here's the deal. As much as I hate taxes, if you don't pay them, the IRS is probably going to come after you. If they catch you, they will fine you. If you don't pay the fines, they will send you to prison. And sometimes they'll send you to prison for making frivolous arguments or committing tax evasion on the first time they catch you. So today I'm calling out the scammers who are running around the internet telling people you don't have to pay taxes. These people are not heroes. They're not patriots. They're scammers. And if you follow their advice, you're the one who's probably going to get burned. These guys piss me off. I spend my days helping people legally avoid taxes, and there are tons of legitimate strategies, deductions, credits, business structures, investment tools, that can let you save thousands or even tens of thousands of dollars perfectly legally. Heck, if you do real estate properly, it is entirely possible to go years or decades without actually owing any income taxes perfectly legally. But these scammers, they're telling people the system doesn't apply. They make it sound easy. You don't have to pay if you say these magic words or if you put this on this form. They sell books, courses, memberships, etc. And regular people, hardworking people, tradesmen, small business owners, regular people get sucked in. And frankly, I find a lot of libertarians get sucked in too. Then the IRS shows up and suddenly that easy trick turns into liens, penalties, and sometimes prison. Pretty much all these scammers rely on two games, and most of them do both, but some of them mix up how much of one or the other they do. But in both cases, it's mostly definitions. So I've seen them say something like, oh, this word means X, and look here, it's in this law. Therefore, that tax law doesn't apply to you. For example, the definition of corporation is much narrower under securities law than under the tax code. So they may point at the definition in securities law and say, oh, you're not a corporation. That doesn't apply to you. Well, it doesn't under securities law, but it does under tax law. Similarly, the definition of employee is much narrower under the Fair Labor Standards Act than the tax code. Typically, owners of companies are not employees under the Fair Labor Standards Act, but they usually are under the tax code. So that's not how the law works. When Congress writes a law, like the Internal Revenue Code, the definitions in that law are what matter. You don't get to pull the definition out of a law book or out of Black's legal dictionary and use that to cancel out the tax code. That's just fantasy land. The more common thing I'm seeing, especially these days, is they go hunting for definitions with the word includes. And then they see, it only applies to what's listed here. But here's the truth, and any lawyer, any first-year law student knows that when the law defines something to include something, it means you take the ordinary meaning of that word and then add whatever is included. So, for example, and I see this a lot with these scammers, they point to the definition of state and the United States. And they say, look, the tax code says that the definition of state includes the District of Columbia. So only the District of Columbia is a state. No, that's not what that means. It means the 50 states plus DC count as states for this tax code. And in both these cases, these scammers are either lying or they forget the most important thing. The law doesn't mean what you think it means when you read it. It means what the courts have interpreted it to mean. In my humble opinion, these courts are often wrong and define laws in really stupid ways. I've literally seen them define or to mean and I've seen them define and to mean or. It doesn't matter. Once those courts define it that way, that's what the law means. So if you're just reading the statutes and you're not looking at the case law, you don't know what the law means. And I get so angry at this because when you follow these scams, you're the one left holding the bag, at least with the IRS. They don't care that you read it on a website or that you watched a video. They don't care that you bought a $5,000 tax freedom course. The IRS is not going to arrest the guys who sold it to you, but they might arrest you. Now, I have seen the FBI go after some of these guys, but usually not. Oh, and by the way, sometimes, a lot of the time, these tax scammers, they're actually paying their taxes because they know they need to. And sometimes the IRS finds these guys and waits and waits and waits. And then after 5 or 6 years, they charge them and they send subpoenas and they get their customer lists. And then they go after all those customers. Now, the courts have ruled on these arguments again and again and again. The IRS literally has an entire webpage going over these arguments and citing the case law as to why they're frivolous arguments. It's like 60 pages if you print it out. Judges throw out these arguments all the time. People go to jail following them. Wesley Snipes, kind of famously, fell into one of these traps. He went to prison. I've seen families ruined by the penalties and the interest and the liens, because someone convinced them they were smarter than the system, and because the IRS has already defined these as frivolous, it's far easier for them to prove evasion, and it's far easier for them to send you to prison. So if you want to pay less in taxes, there are real ways to do it. That's what I help people do. If you run a business, you structure it smartly to save on self-employment taxes. You make sure you're taking as many business deductions for your expenses as you can. If you own property and you rent it out, it's real estate, that's investment. You can use cost segregation. You can use bonus depreciation. You can use cash out refinances. There's lots of ways to save money on taxes. There's lots of ways to invest and get deductions or even tax credits. But none of this happens by ignoring the law. It happens by using the tax law. It's tax judo. Use the law against them. That's what the wealthy do. That's what smart business owners do. They don't fall for the scammers promising magic words. They use strategies that actually work and that hold up in an audit. So don't fall for the lies. Don't let these scammers talk you into being the next headline about some sovereign citizen who thought he outsmarted the IRS. There are plenty of legal, legitimate ways to slash your taxes, but pretending the system doesn't apply to you is not one of them. If you want to see how the tax code really works to your advantage, please go to agristaxadvice.com/TSP. That'll get you on my email list where I share strategies to keep you safe, save you money, and keep you out of prison. Thanks, everyone.
You know, the thing is, again, I want to just say it. There is ways to pay almost nothing in taxes with very high cash flows, and it usually involves real estate and or leveraging debt. There's also ways to create massive amounts of deductions by how you structure your life if you are a business owner. And you can only push that so far, but you can push it pretty far. I will tell you that today I pay about the same tax as I did when I made half the money and I wasn't a business owner. Okay? And nothing I do is illegal. Nothing I do is even not in the spirit of the law and the code. And I'll tell you, when you really need to run away from somebody, when they say they can't show you the law that says you have to file a tax return, because there is a law, but it's a code, because the government passed a law giving taxing authority to the Internal Revenue Service, and then the Internal Revenue Service drafts the code by which the taxes are collected. And you can argue, and as Matt said, I think one of the most important things is you can hear some sort of thing about how this law really means this and it doesn't mean that, and it can even be in the spirit of the law correct. It won't matter when a judge drops the gavel and says that you are going to be garnished in your income for the rest of your natural life and do 6 months in a freaking jail because you listened to some dumbass who told you you didn't have to pay taxes. And he's dead on when he tells you some of these people, they do eat their own dog food and they do the same thing because they really believe their own bullshit. But there's a lot of them that when their students started getting nailed and then the government turned and went after them, it turned out the whole time Billy Bob, who told you didn't have to pay, he was paying his taxes. It's happened more than once. And in the case of some people, Peter Schiff's father, Erwin Schiff, the people doing it that were not paying taxes as well, they were doing it the way they said, they died in prison. This is not the way to be free and liberated and fight for your freedom and liberty. I'm a tax protester. Yeah, enjoy your time in jail. Enjoy having everything you own seized. And enjoy having every dollar you make for the rest of your life garnished until you make the government whole, which is almost impossible to do once you end up in that situation. Just saying. But you do what you want to do. Just stop emailing me the bullshit. I don't want it anymore. Anyway, moving on. Let's answer three non-serious fitness-related questions with Andy McCann. Goats, shovels, zombies, and all.
Hey, guys. This is Andy McCann coming to you from Woodstock, Georgia, where I own CrossFit Garage, and I'm trying to help you be healthy and fit as best as I can, either here in Woodstock or remotely. So I had a couple questions come in, and they are really funny. Typically, I'm answering serious questions. It's like life or death. It's health. I mean, we want to know this stuff. So I'm going to try to do all three of them. I've got more than that. I got 10, but I got three questions that I think are going to be pretty funny and interesting and just may make you laugh for today, because sometimes you don't need to be serious. All right, here's the first one. Andy, what is the best fitness program for defeating zombies with a shovel while carrying a goat? Okay, so I'm going to say the goat is going to be a distraction material, so throw the goat to the zombies so you can get away. And the shovel is for, killing the zombies, right? So what fitness program would I use? If you watched Zombieland, it's all about cardio, right? You need to cardio up. Don't worry about muscle. Don't worry about what you eat. Get as many calories as you possibly can. So I guess the program I would use is sprint intervals, because I don't have to jog for a long ways, but I'm going to get a big bang for the buck for the sprint style training. So what they have found over time, and you can look at videos, pictures, or whatever of sprinters and see the body type of a sprinter versus the body type of a marathon runner. Here's the interesting thing. The sprinter is going to be able to do more things in life. Maybe not run a marathon great, but they still can. Whereas a marathon runner isn't going to be able to lift and carry and all that stuff. So there's a high value in this sprint or intensity mentality. And that's kind of why CrossFit uses that. But I would go for sprint intervals. And I would probably carry my shovel to make sure I could run with it. And if I didn't have to throw the goat to the zombies to distract, then of course I would eat the goat. Okay, here's another funny one. If you had to escape the FEMA camp, how would you train? Okay, so yes, I am not the type of guy where I think FEMA's taking over. But if FEMA puts you in a camp, which I guess, hey, they build those things, right? What would I use? So they're going to be watching, and your training is more to get you away rather than it is for your health and fitness. So I would probably say I would do a lot of push-ups and burpees and then maybe even plank holds, because I would imagine while you're escaping, one, it's going to be dark, so I would practice getting better night vision. So I think you can do this thing where you take your fingers and you make a tiny, tiny hole between your index finger and your thumb. You put those together on your right and left hand and you look through it. And I've heard that trains your eye to be, see better. I don't know if it's true, but I would definitely train your own dark vision. So be able to, like when the lights go out, remember where stuff is and see if you can start picking up hints of it with the moonlight, right? So because you're going to be able to, when you escape, you're going to be able to, need to be able to see in the dark. Okay, the other thing is, you're probably going to need to wait patiently in very awkward positions. So plank positions or sit on the wall position. So any like really tough static position, because you're going to need to be able to be silent and stay until, I don't know, the guard passes or whatever. So you're still, it's dark, you got those things covered. The other is you probably want to actually be thinner without losing your muscle mass. So I would probably trade out, even to a 10-to-1 ratio, all of your bread for somebody else's protein. So, hey, here's 10 loaves of bread for your one chicken breast or something, right? So maximize the carnivore effect, the whole thing that Jack talks about with his YouTube videos on getting in keto and losing all that extra fat. So you want to slim yourself down so you can squeeze through the bars, the imaginary bars that are out there. So I would do a lot of sit still, like plank holds and stuff, drop weight, and work on my night vision. In the end times, can you build muscle on a carnivore diet if your only equipment is an axe, a tire, and a stubborn chicken? So, okay, let's kind of position that one. It's end times, whatever that means to you. I don't really think you need to be building muscle, so I'm going to go don't even worry about it, just get through it. But can you build muscle? Man, yes, the answer is yes. You can build muscle at any time. If I had an axe and a tire, so I'd flip the axe over and use the dull side and do a lot of tire smashes. And then I guess if the tire is heavy enough, I would do slow back squats or deadlifts, maybe step in the middle of the tire and then grab onto it and pull it up depending on how heavy it is. So I would do a time under tension type of environment. Since I can't change the weight of the tire, what I can do is slow my movement down. So it's just incredibly tough because, I'm putting a lot more of that the weight on me over that longer period of time. So time under tension is, instead of doing a back squat, like I go down for 1 second and I go up in 1 second, instead I drop down into my squat in 5 seconds. So it's super slow, and man, does that hurt. That'll build muscle just differently than if you did straight hypertrophy. Now, the stubborn chicken, I guess I would hope the chicken is a hen and I would let it lay some eggs and I would eat those eggs as some protein. So the answer is yes, you can, but I would do it differently. Okay, I'm about to hit my time limit here. So guys, this is Andy McCann. I do have a podcast called Fitness, Food, and Finance. You can hear all the dumb questions there. And if you go to my website, crossfitgarage.com/free, there's a bunch of stuff I've made for you guys. Hopefully see you guys at the fall workshop, where I've got a presentation that's going to be called You Are the First Prep, or something like that. We'll see.
All right, next up, let's hear from Joel Riles on repetitive behavioral issues from the dog and how understanding how to interpret your dog's body language can aid you with correction of that. And on that last one from Andy, I will admit that's a bit of an older one. He sent that quite a while ago. And I have a lot of reserve from Andy. He's really great about sending me content. But I held on to that one longer than normal to get us a little bit closer to October, given the zombie angle. All right, let's go ahead and hear from Joel.
Hello, TSP crew. This is Joel Riles with Fortress Canine and Canine Academy coming back at you with another expert counsel segment. All right, today let's talk about correcting things that your dog does repetitively. So this is often an issue that people run into, whether they're walking with their dog at their side and their dog repetitively gets ahead of them. Or they put their dog in a place in their house, and the second they leave the room, their dog breaks and gets out of position. Anything where your dog is repetitively breaking a command or repetitively doing a behavior that you don't like, one of the biggest reasons people have this issue is because they don't anticipate that the dog is going to do it and correct the second the dog starts thinking about doing it and not waiting until they actually do it. Now, this is a subjective thing that you have to be able to read the dog and kind of see what they're about to do. But if I'm foosing with a dog and they start to put their head toward the ground, right at that moment, I know this dog is no longer paying attention to me and what we're doing. It's starting to look for scent. And I give it a little bump and I say, hey, pay attention, foos with me. And so I want to catch that dog the second they start to get distracted from what we're doing and not wait until they put their nose to the ground, start sniffing, and then pull ahead. Or if I'm walking with a dog and I know I have cats around, and the minute I see my dog look up and identify a cat and maybe want to start moving towards it a little bit, I go, boom, hey, foos with me, stay with me. So what we want to start doing in these repetitive processes, these repetitive behaviors that the dogs are doing, is we want to get ahead of them. A lot of people wait until the dog does the thing, then they usually wait a couple seconds after the dog does the thing, and then they try to correct the behavior. And while it'll correct it in that moment typically, it just keeps happening over and over and over again. And the reason this is happening is because you're not anticipating that it's going to happen and then correct it when the dog is thinking about doing it, not when they're actually doing it. So what I want my dogs to think is, holy crap, this guy can read my brain. And if you observe your dog, you will be able to tell when they're thinking about doing a thing before they do it. So here's a classic example. If you have your dog up on a platform and they look at the ground, they do that just before they jump off the platform, right? They're looking for, where am I going to land? They look down there, and if you wait for them to jump, now you're trying to catch a dog midair and tell them, you know, get back into your place and all this other kind of stuff. Whereas if I see the dog look at the ground and I grab the lead and I go, fooey that, you wait. They were thinking about jumping down there and I said, no, no, don't do that. Stay in your place. Right? So I'm catching them before they're even doing the act so that they stop thinking about doing the act. And in their dog brains, they're like, wow, this guy knows what I'm going to do before I even do it. Okay, I guess I won't do it. Right. The other thing that we can start doing is we can start setting the dog up slightly for failure. So what I mean by this is, if the dog likes to get ahead of me, right, and I maybe give them a bump back and they come back for a second, they go right back out, and they come back for a second, go right back out. There's two things going on here. One is the dog is using the lead to tell where his handler is. And so he pulls up until there's tension, and then he uses that tension to tell where his handler is. So I can take that away by giving a little bit of extra lead, like an extra foot of lead, right? So now I've got this loop in my lead, so the dog can't use that. The only way they're going to use it then is to go all the way out to that extra foot, which now they're way out of position, right? So sometimes just dropping that loop, they'll back up because they're like, whoa, all my input from the lead went away. I need to back up so I can see my person. Sometimes that does work. But a lot of times what happens is what they're doing is they're not even cheating and telling where you are by the lead. They're just interested in what's out in front of them, and they're kind of ignoring you a little bit. And they just pull up till they feel tension, but they're really focused out there. They're not focused on their handler. So when that happens, I'll drop that extra like 1 to 2 feet of lead, and then I just go turn, and I turn, and I bam with the lead. Now, if the dog is paying attention to me and they come to my side, they won't get corrected. But if they're not paying attention to me, they're continuing on in the direction they're going, I've turned to go a different direction, boom, they get corrected with the lead. But when they come up to me, I don't fuss at them and act like there's anything wrong. I just go, good foos. And I'll do that until the dog stops going out ahead and they stay with me. Right, so there's various different ways that you can set these different exercises up. If it's a place in the house and you want your dog to wait in a place in the house, and every time you leave the room, they get out of position, well, then what I want to do is put them in the position, and I want to go to where I'm about to step out of their sight, and I step out of their sight for like 1 second, and I step back. And if they're still in position, I go, good, wait. If they started to move, I walk over, I correct them, I put them back, and I do it again. And then pretty soon I'll be able to step behind the corner, open the refrigerator and get a drink and walk back in, and they'll still be in position. And then I can go for a minute, and then I can go for 5 minutes, and then I can go for 10 minutes. But you have to work each of these exercises on their own independently, and you have to anticipate what the dog's going to do, use their failure to teach them, and then be consistent in that as you go through your program so that your dog knows, I always do this thing when my person tells me to do X. So I hope that's been helpful for you guys. If you have any other questions, you can always reach out to me. My email is joel@fortresscanine.com. You can send me any questions that you have there. If you already have a dog and you want more help training your dog, check out Canine Academy. Go to thesurvivalpodcast.com, Jack's website. Click on the Canine Academy banner on his website and check it out. We have a bunch of different options for different levels of training that you have there. And if you're looking for a working line puppy or a fully trained protection dog, check out fortresscanine.com. Fill out the consultation form and we'd be happy to reach out and communicate with you and see if we can provide something that'd be of use. Until next time, remember to train hard and stay safe.
Yeah, I just want to reiterate on being able to anticipate the dog based on its body language, its mannerisms, whatever it is something that you can do because it's your dog and you're with it all the time. And what you need to start doing is keeping an eye on the animal. And when it exhibits a behavior that you don't want, you need to be able to use your mental computer and say, what did it do just before it did this? And when you see it more than once, it's a pattern. And once you know that, that's the thing. And different dogs have different things. There's some very common things they'll do. One of the common things for a dog that's not like a dog that's trained to bite but is going to bite to do is approach from the, like, it'll side into you with its shoulder, and then it'll reach out to the side. So it's giving you its shoulder, and then it'll bite you. I've learned that from vets. They all say when a dog moves up on them that way, they know that dog is at least likely to bite. Even if it's not, because a lot of times dogs are wanting to bite, won't. It's a foreign thing for them in some ways. But there are little things that you can begin to notice. My dog Charlie was a great dog, but he had some real aggression. I mean, he had that pit bull thing in him, and it was a pit bull bird dog. So it kind of really has two different types of aggression. And with him, all I had to do is look at him, and if he was getting at the least bit aggressive, his ears would begin to move forward. I don't mean up like a dog listening, where a dog kind of puts his ears up and gets direction. I mean his ears would literally move forward on his head to the point where the other dogs and the other animals, if he was being aggressive toward them and he moved his ears that way, they understood instantly. So when I ever saw him do that in a situation where aggression was unwanted, it was an immediate, you know, there's different corrections. Joel has his commands. My universal correction for I don't want you to do the thing that you're about to do is just at. I mean, that's, and I've trained that into them since they're little, where I'll put food in front of their face and say no. And that should be enough. But if they look like they're going to take that food out of my hand before I tell them it's okay, at. And so they know that when my human goes at, I need to not, like, I'm in shit. And they know that somehow, like he said, like, he knows. How the hell does he know? I didn't even do it yet. But it's like dealing with a kid. You're dealing with, like, the animal has the athletic capacity of a 20-year-old athlete in the intellectual capacity of a four-year-old kid, in the vocabulary of somewhere between a four-year-old and a 12-year-old, depending on the dog, is my opinion. Now, he don't have the vocabulary to talk to you, but he had to understand you. Like, some dogs you can use sentences to communicate with, and most dogs you can't. Anyway, just pay attention to body language when you identify the pattern, identify the time and type of correction, and it'll go a long way. It'll make your life easier as a dog owner, too. And remember, if you want to learn more from Joel, he is a sponsor, Fortress Canine. Canine Academy, canineacademy.us. Fortress Canine's his other business where they actually sell dogs. Check that out, canineacademy.us. Next up, let's talk about weed. Yep, weed. We're going to talk about weed. I'm going to get all that weed. Joe Pieweed. Joe Pieweed and Ironweed with Kerry Brown.
Hey, TSP community. Kerry here from Strong Roots Resources. And tonight I want to bring to you a couple of wildflowers that are very prevalent and incredibly eye-catching, in my opinion. These are currently blooming. So both of these pretty much bloom between early to mid-August, generally all the way up through October. So what I want to talk about tonight is both Joe Pieweed and Ironweed. So I'm going to start with Joe Pieweed here. There is some documentation in the era of colonial New England that Joe Pieweed was named after a folk medicine practitioner who found that, or was informed in some way, I don't really know the exact story, but that this plant could be used to address typhoid fever. So that's where that name comes from. So that's Joe, as in first name Joe, Pie, P-Y-E. Really tall plant, really distinctive plant. If I didn't mention already, it is a native to North America perennial plant. It can get 7, 10, 12 feet tall, depending on how, basically the better the soil, the taller the plant. It likes kind of full to partial sun. You'll see it, you've probably seen it alongside highways, your country roads, your back roads. Tall plant with whorled leaves, so those leaves are coming out in groupings at kind of equidistant spacing on the stem instead of alternating leaves. And the flower color is pretty distinctive. It's kind of like this light pink to even a light peach color, I've noticed. And most of the time, you get one big dome-shaped cluster of flowers per stem. But one plant itself can set many, many stems. So I mentioned typhus, typhoid fever, also used for rheumatism, gout, women's health issues, anemia, painful periods, things of that nature. And these forms kind of vary between root teas and decoctions, tinctures. So check your herbal medicine manual for that. But I kind of feel like an overlooked medicinal plant. And, you know, very hardy. This is also an example of a plant that makes sense for you to not cut it down to the ground at the end of the season. Let those stems stay intact. Those stems house all kinds of beneficial insects. So the second one I want to bring to you here, ironweed. Ironweed, at least in my area, seems to be a little bit more common. You'll see this quite a bit in old pastures. This is where it shows up most here. The leaves are very, very bitter, so the sheep tend to skip over this one. So I still have areas of this ironweed still hanging out, but I'm making sure that there's certain areas where it's going to remain because it's just such a beautiful, useful plant. So as you may guess from the name ironweed, this is another one that is going to help with blood cell reproduction. So if you're dealing with anemia, it's also been documented to be used after childbirth to help with support recovery of uterine health. Also is a fever remedy. As kind of a what one of my books phrased as a blood builder and a general tonic. One other here, from the root, teas and poultices for toothaches, arthritis, and general body pain. And this might be one that I might need to test in real time, because I suspect I've got a tooth that's starting to give me some trouble. So primarily we're talking about using the roots of this plant and the leaf for teas, decoctions, and poultices. There isn't as much clinical documented research on this one, but I do find that it's addressed in the Herbal Medicine Handbook and Rosemary Gladstar's work and that sort of thing. So ironweed is another really tall one, and there are like giant versions. I'd say the ones I see on my farm hit about 8 feet in general. So the leaves on these, because the Joe Pye weed leaf and the ironweed leaf, the shape of the leaf is similar, but the arrangement of the leaf is very different. So the ironweed is going to have alternating or staggered leaves. And the flower cluster is definitely distinctive from Joe Pye, even if you're just starting to really learn your plants. These set clusters of multiple small clusters of deep purple, almost even bluish flowers. They are just, I think they're beautiful. They are kind of reminds me a little bit of the early stage of a thistle bloom when those flowers are coming out. And they will also be in, they'll be in bloom basically until we get cold weather. I've got some right now that are already starting to set seed, but I've got others in other, you know, varying microclimates that are, you know, just starting to bloom. So very extended bloom time. And they're just, I think they're stunning. I think they're real eye catchers. They are great in pollinator gardens. I have no problem having them in pastures. Probably the only thing I would suggest is, depending on how your aesthetics work, maybe don't plant these right up against your house or even in front of a window, because they really get big, and they're both perennials, so they're going to kind of clump themselves as they divide, and they're going to get thicker and thicker and thicker, and you're probably going to want to eventually get in there and actually divide up those crowns when they're dormant and share the love. So that's ironweed and Joe Pye weed there for you. Thank you guys for listening, and if I can help you out with any of your homestead needs, plant identification, understanding your landscape, everything from the regenerative lens, please give me a shout. Reach out to me through strongrootsresources.com, and we will talk to you next time.
I mean, y'all know Kerry was one of the more recent additions to the expert council. We added him this year, and what a gain. Really, what a gain. I was really hoping he was going to be, he's got a new kiddo coming, right? So he couldn't, but I was really hoping he'd come to the fall workshop. I would have loved to have had him, Nick Ferguson, and I on a plant panel with Alan Booker, because that would have totally happened if he would have come. Anyway, next up, we're going to apply the iron triangle of project management to knife sharpening. Can you do that? Yeah, you can actually apply this iron triangle to many things.
Hey guys, it's Patrick with MT Knives coming to you today with today's expert council segment of the week. And today we're going to talk about the project management triangle, which also is referred to as the iron triangle. And if you haven't heard of this before, it's the fast, good, or cheap pick two. Anytime you have a project that you want to do, you've got to choose. Do you want it done fast? Do you want it done good? Or do you want it done cheap? And in the same manner, when it comes to sharpening knives and having a good edge, you can have it sharp, you can have it tough, or you can have it time, you know, your time, your quick, how long is it going to take? The quality of the steel. So when it comes to sharpening, the lower angle that you have when sharpening is going to determine how sharp that knife is. you can either choose to have a knife that is really sharp, but is going to be not as tough, or you can choose to have a knife that is tough, but not quite as sharp. And then the third part of that triangle is the quality of the steel in which you use to make that cutting tool out of. If you choose a higher quality steel, it's going to cost more, but then the cost is not just in the cost of the steel. Also, we have the hardness of the steel. And the hardness and the type of the steel is going to dictate how long it's going to take to sharpen that edge. Your higher hardness, higher quality steels are going to take longer to sharpen. So, you know, it's this triangle of decisions we make to determine, like, at what point is there kind of a point of diminishing returns? Sometimes we don't need the best steel out there. We just need something that's going to get the job done and can quickly have an edge put back on it. So in picking knives and picking, like, how we sharpen them and the performance that we're looking to get out of it, we have to ask ourselves kind of the same questions that a project manager would go through. Is like, hey, are we looking for something that's just fast, down and dirty? Are we looking for something that's going to take a little more time, be a little bit better quality? And all this comes with just experience, time, actually using and learning what steel, what angles, what edges works for what we're trying to accomplish. And most people end up with just living with what they have. And I think that with a little bit of education, with a little bit of practice and time put into it, we can have a lot more satisfaction in the things that we do and the tools that we use. And just overall end up with a more better quality of life in doing things. So I was talking to a friend earlier this week who was just getting back from elk hunting and processing some elk. And he was calling me because he's had my Genesis knife for many years. And he was telling me how much he appreciated it and how good of a knife it was. And he was saying that he can't quite get it to where it was as sharp as it was when he got it. And so we're kind of helping him through that process. And anyways, once you've experienced using sharp tools, quality tools, you just don't want to go back to using anything else. Professionals know. Professionals that do stuff for a living, well, most professionals know. Once you've experienced using quality tools with quality edges, you just are not satisfied with anything else. So I hope this helps. So I hope you find this information helpful. If you have some questions, feel free to shoot them to me, pastor@mtknives.net. Thank you for tuning in and listening, and we will see you next time. Have a great day.
This is a really interesting application of the Iron Triangle. The whole concept is that in most situations, you'll come down to three things that you want. I mean, obviously, the perfect knife would be easy and quick to sharpen, super sharp, hold its edge really well, right? Like, that's what it would be. It'd be easy to sharpen and super sharp and hold its edge. But you don't get that. You get to pick two. And this is always relative as well. Like I said, we used to do this in the computer hardware sales industry. We would tell customers you can have fast and reliable, but it won't be cheap. You can have reliable and cheap, but it won't be fast. You can fast and cheap, but it won't be reliable. Now, those are subjective. It didn't mean that we couldn't. It just meant that the other alternative that gave up something else was better in that respect. And what we would describe at the time is fast, reliable, and cheap all in one. You can buy it today, right? There's network equipment you can buy today that compared to what I was selling 30 years ago, that was the dark ages. And you say, well, that broke the Iron Triangle. But no, it didn't, because there's going to be an equal piece of equipment to current technology that follows the same triangle. That's why you can bend it, but it's really hard to break it. And this is really interesting to me because it's true in so many things in life. And it leads back to what I call the rule of threes, which is a different application of it. But it will always make it, just for marketing purposes, very, very powerful. And it's why whenever I'm writing ad copy, marketing copy, sales scripting, etc., I always try to use three things when I'm pointing out a benefit, right? Fast, reliable, and cheap would be good if you could actually do it, right? Fast, reliable, and inexpensive, though. That maybe we can pull off, because inexpensive is relative to something else. Here's why. Human psychology 101. If I'm trying to rage bait somebody, they can only be really, really angry about one thing at a time. That's how anger works. The human, if you noticed, whatever people are most upset about, even though there's plenty of other things that are enraging, they focus on the one thing. And as soon as they pull off of that to put attention on the second issue, the first one just kind of fades away into history. So when it comes to rage and anger, people can only really focus on one thing at a time. But when it comes to day-to-day thought processing in the moment, and I'm not talking like over an hour, I'm talking like this moment right here while I'm talking to you, the human mind in general can hold three things at one point in time that are beneficial. So if I use two, the mind is looking for the third, and if I use fourth, it discards one. And that's why, like, when I was working with Sirian and Neil Franklin, and they wanted a message for the company, the message I came up for them with this software and this algorithm-based system that determined how, you know, cellular data networks were going to function or not function, it was analyze, apply, achieve. Because even when we were talking to super smart network engineers, that filled that void. And it's really interesting to me how many places and how many times and how many different ways that three comes back, including some religious connotations. It's really interesting to me. It's something to keep in mind as you're building messaging for anything. And the fact that, generally speaking, when you look at the things that are most important of a thing, whether it's a plan or a table or a piece of equipment, usually the three things that matter most, one will suffer to the exclusion of the other two. That's the iron triangle. All right. With that, let's talk about what I want to talk about today, which is a really simple observation. And I talked about this a lot during the COVID years. But the way I'm talking about it now is more from the standpoint of general political disagreement and violence and anger and censorship. People who can win an intellectual debate do not get violent or use censorship over the debate. And this is what I mean. Let's say you and I are going to debate something, and we have a legitimate academic-style debate, and I wipe the floor with you. I'm probably not going to then want to walk over to you and hit you. And those are the people that showed up there to listen to me, that believed what I believe and agreed with me all the time, want to do you any harm. But it's often the case, if you lose and lose badly, that there's bad emotions and bad feelings on the other side. Now, there are many debates that, depending on the people doing the debating, they could go either way. There are many debates where indeed both sides have valid points. When I was in high school, we would do debates. Yes, I was the geek in debate club. And we would have something like this happen. Not every debate, but sometimes this was a debate. Here is the issue. You and you will be debating each other. Here's the thing. You don't get to pick which side of the debate you're on, and I'm not going to tell you. In fact, I don't even know. On Wednesday, when y'all debate in front of the class, or you did, so there was debate competitions too, when you debate, you'll find out which side of the issue you have to take 5 minutes before the debate. Good luck. Now, what that made you do is you had to go back and examine both sides of the debate and show up capable of defending either side and attacking either side. This is, I believe that's one of the few things I got from school that actually benefits me to this day. How to basically read, write, and do math benefits me to this day. Some of the stuff I learned in history and science benefits me to this day. And that fact as well, that if you want to understand the debate, you must be able to intellectually comprehend both sides and argue both sides. Here's the thing. a lot of the things that are making people really upset and get really violent about right now, I can't do it. And I don't mean because I have a moral problem with the other side. I mean because you can't do it. You cannot defend with any intellectual honesty some of these positions right now. You cannot defend with intellectual honesty that a human being can change its gender because it mentally decided to do so. You cannot morally defend, but nor can you intellectually defend that any child was born in the wrong body. If somebody really believes I was born in the wrong body, this is a mental problem, not a physical problem. And the one place, whenever somebody says to me, well, Jack, how many genders are there? I generally say, well, if you want to be completely accurate, I will go with three. I know that just shocked you. Wait a minute. Let me tell you what they are. Male, female, hermaphroditic. And you could also make the intellectual argument that there's still two because hermaphroditic is just the two together in one. But that's not normal. We got to call it something. I'll give you there's a third, and that third is a true hermaphrodite, which is very, very rare. And that person I have a lot of sympathy for. And that person, either their parents do it for them or they do it later in life, kind of has to decide, well, which way am I going to go with this? But now we got an LGBTQI plus blah, 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 blah. Well, they're non-binary, non-conformist, transsexual from, say what, Nao that lives the Confederate life of a, I don't know. Right? That's where it all goes stupid. Even when you, so you give an inch, they take 1,000 miles. But that's why they get violent. That's why they get violent when they start making a lot of these claims. All of these third world immigrants that are coming here with no real marketable skills who want government money and a place to stay are going to improve America. Really? Then why can't they improve where they're from? If there are strength, like you bring these people in, and I'm not talking about all immigrants, so don't go there. When you talk about defending all immigrants, and you're including the type of people I'm talking about in this, and you're making no allowances for, there are people that you could bring into your country you'd be better off not bringing into your country. Not all people that want to come here should be allowed to. You can't make an honest intellectual argument on the other side of that claim. It cannot be done. It can't be done. You can't make an intellectual argument that, well, the kid that shot Charlie Kirk really was right-wing. That can't be done. This infuriates the left. There are so many things that they cannot stand and argue. And then there's really multiple phases of this. The whole thing, like I said, people, you're just attached to the trans thing. No, it's just the most blatantly stupid thing I've ever heard in my life, and half of the damn country believes it. That's not me being obsessed. That's me being fucking observant. You understand that, okay? But that's just one piece of this nonsense. And it's a perfect representation of an issue where you cannot argue the other side in good faith intellectually. It's not doable. There is no intellectual or scientific case to be made for it. There's no scientific case to be made for claiming that science is ever settled. Because questioning science is science. These are the things you can, that it can't be done. Then there's the phase two stuff. And this is where the left could be capable of defending their ideas. Even if in the end they're wrong, they could defend it if they were informed, but they're not. So the phase two, which becomes, we have a disagreement, but the one side that's sure that it's right does not have any comprehension of the totality of the issue, so it becomes a phase one issue. In other words, it cannot be intellectually defended. Now, while that's all going on, if you convince these people you're smarter than the other side, you guys are geniuses, you all are properly educated in a magical fairyland known as college, and the only reason that somebody else that went to fairyland college with you disagrees with you is they were corrupted by the fascists. Right, they should agree with you too because they're properly educated. And these people are just a bunch of dumbass bumpkins. They don't know anything. Yes, you're correct. You really are a woman or a man, even though you're not. right? Yes, you're correct. Everything should be given to you, whether you deserve it or not. Yes, you're correct. Somebody else should fix all your problems for you. And you keep reinforcing that message, and then these people are ill-equipped to defend intellectually their arguments. Once that argument actually becomes mainstream, and they realize that it cannot be defended, they have to make one or two choices. Live in defiance of logic or change their mind. Very few people, when they've gone out and shown their ass and said it and repeated it over and over again, very few people, when they've based decisions in their lives on these beliefs, have the mental fortitude to accept the fact, wait a minute, I could be wrong. So when they're really pushed, and when the other side finally says, all right, enough of your childish bullshit. If you say this is true, let's discuss it openly and academically in public. A very large portion, not the majority, but a very significant and a large portion of, let's say, 100 million people or a third of the country, that's a shitload of people, are going to get violent. And then here's the bigger thing. The people that have caused all this fully know this. They knew what they were doing the whole time. They've been working on this little project for about 100 years, since the 1920s, when they first invaded the university system in this country with Marxist ideology. Now, again, I could actually make an argument for Marxism. I would hate myself the entire time, but there's enough material to work with there that you can make a coherent argument for it, even if you're wrong. But many of these issues no longer have a coherent argument to be made. And when you create mental illness en masse, and then you dump psychotropic medication on it en masse, and then you get people to the point where they are obsessed with a screen en masse, and then you put them into a position to defend that which is not defendable, you will get violence. And again, the real crime in all this is the people who have done it knew what they were doing and expected it for decades. They've expected this to happen. They're overjoyed by this. They're overjoyed by this. There's people whose names you will never know, worth more money than you could imagine, that sit back like Mr. Burns with their fingertips going together saying excellent to what's happening right now. You know what else you don't do when you can have a coherent, logical, intellectual argument and make your case well? You don't censor the other side. And don't give me this shit about Jimmy Kimmel. I already spoke on that enough. I don't need to say that anymore. I don't give a fuck about Jimmy Kimmel. I don't care. Those days are over. I want anybody who has to suffer for being this stupid to suffer for it. I don't care anymore. But censorship itself, where you are able to shut down the ability of a person to communicate simply because you don't like what they're saying, you have already conceded that you are incapable of countering what they're saying, or you would just do that. It's a pretty simple concept. And if I seem off-timed at all today during the show, or if I'm like humming, or they, I was going to tell you, about every 2 minutes today that I've been talking, I've had to hit pause on the recording because I got F-35s damn near shaking the windows out of my house. Anyway, that wraps up my segment for today. That's just my point in general, that when you can argue your point, you have no need to silence the other side. You have no need to get violent with the other side. But when you get tired of losing and you can't find a way to win, then you react with violence. That's what's happening to the left. In other words, what I'm telling you is, as bad as it looks, we're reaching an end game right now. The problem is the end game can be short, and can be mostly productive, or it can be long and extremely agonizing, and we don't know which one it's going to be yet, so you better be prepared for both. With that, I've wrapped up another week. Again, reminder for those that jump ahead in the beginning, we are moving the workshop back to Nine Mile Farm. It will be at my house. I'll be trying to reach out to everybody between today and tomorrow that's registered as a student to make sure you have the proper address and all that. Please, if you know other people going and you're not sure if they've, you tell them for me. I'm going to do everything I can to reach everybody. It's not what I wanted to happen, but it's okay. I had a lot of people go, man, I'm sorry for you. That's really bad. It's not. I mean, again, we have to do a thing that we know exactly how to do that we've done over 30 times over 11 years, 12 years. It's okay. And I do look forward to seeing everybody at my place at least one more time. That'll be fun. With that, remember, you can always help support the show doing your online shopping at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. And the item of the day is the same all week because it's such a damn good deal. It is the Anker Soundcore V20i open-ear headphones. These have the hooks that go over the ears so they don't fall out into the duck pond or the garden or the grass under the lawnmower or whatever, like the ones that just stick in your ear do. They retail for about $60. They're on sale for $23 and change. I don't know how much longer they're going to stay that way, so get them all you can. I bought a second pair right away because I just thought they were such a great deal. And after I got the first ones, I'm like, I better pick up another pair before I release them and you hooligans buy them all up. But they're still available this week. Again, it's the Anker Soundcore V20i open-ear headphones. Awesome, awesome product. And I don't know about you guys, but I've always had a problem with the earbuds that don't have the hooks. They just... especially in my left ear. I don't know what it is. And right when that's going to fall out is right when your hands are covered in mud and the mosquito's biting you in the nose for some reason. And your head's directly over something like a pond. That's just how it works. So now I don't have to worry. At least I can't get rid of the mud and the mosquito. But at least I don't have to worry about the earbuds falling out. And you don't have to either. Anchor's just a great company to do business with. Take care, guys. I'll catch you next Monday with another episode of the show. You should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.